Good evening, everyone. The Joint Committee on Special Session will now return to order. Thank you for joining us for the public testimony this evening. We are scheduled for a public hearing and possible work sessions on the bills that were introduced as committee bills as legislative concepts earlier today. Here is the plan. We'd like to start off with a discussion of Senate Bill 862 relating to public employee retirement that was previously LC2. There were some changes, so we'll have Legislative Council walk us through those. And if there is anyone to testify on that bill, please let us know. We didn't have anyone signed up, but that's where we'll start. Then we will move to Senate Bill 863. Which is relating to the preemption of the local regulation of agriculture. That was previously LC5-3, I believe, and that was the bill that we didn't have in front of us last week, and we'll have Elsie come and walk through the bill with us, and then we will take public testimony on 863, and then we will move to Senate Bill 861, which is relating to cost of living adjustments under HERS. We cannot go to the House bills until 6:20, which are the bills relating to taxation and the budget appropriation bills because of when they were introduced in the House. So we'll start with the Senate bills, and probably by the time we get through, we'll be able to move into the House bills. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 862. And Marissa, probably just helpful to general review of the bill, but then talk to the specific changes from last week.
Sure.
Since last week. Thank you.
And Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Marissa James, Deputy Legislative Counsel. So Senate Bill 862 was the second PERS bill that had three additional concepts in addition to the COLA. The first concept excluded certain payments for insurance from final average salary for OPSERP members, Tier 3 members. In this new version, we added a provision that the increases in salary would only be excluded from final average salary if they're not offered to all employees in the same class of employees. That should address a concern that employers would not be able to provide salary increases broadly in exchange for employees going perhaps to the health insurance exchange. So that was the change to that concept. The second concept dealt with execution, garnishment, and attachment of distributions. The earlier version applied to any crime. This version only applies to felony crimes. Also, the applicability was changed to make the bill apply only to felonies committed on or after the effective date. And then your third concept was about legislators in PERS. We didn't really change anything in that section, just one very technical change. It deals with the deferred comp and the limits to which legislators could contribute to the deferred comp plan on their own. Would you like me to walk through what the legislator piece does again, or is everybody familiar with that?
Doesn't look like it. Maybe we'll go to questions. Thank you, Marissa. Questions for Legislative Council? Senator Devlin.
Senator Winters and I were asked a question by a party that's here on the criminal convictions portion. What happens for an individual that is convicted, then on appeal the conviction is set aside?
That is a good question. Chair Kotek, Senator Devlin, those are the kind of issues that are going to have to be worked out as this provision is used, because there is not an answer to that question in the provision.
Further questions for Legislative Council on Senate Bill 862? Yes, Representative?
In the very first concept, you said that the change is that they're going to apply it evenly across all employees, because that could be difficult to manage across all employees. You mentioned something about because of them going into the health exchange. Can you just repeat what that was? Because I didn't quite catch.
Chair Kotek, Representative Parrish, the idea would be that if an employer was going to give a salary increase to a broad class of employees and then not offer health insurance, but the employees could get their health insurance through the health insurance exchange, that some employers might want to do that, and that should not affect final average salary.
Okay. Thank you, Marisa. And I think the goal there is to make sure you're treating all employees of a certain class the same way at the certain time in their payment schedule. So.
But they could still at some point say that they want their employees to go into the exchange, or we're not letting them do that yet.
I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
Oh, whether or not that at some point in time they could go into the exchange. If that would be up to the employer.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Other questions for Marisa on this bill?
This only has
All right, then. I think we actually do have someone signed up to testify. Thank you, Marisa. Mary Botkin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mary Botkin. We actually, for the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, this is less bad. I'm not going to say it's good. It's less bad. And so, with having said that, let me just say a couple of things that we have some concern about. And one of the issues, the main issue that we have with this bill right now, is that under the felony issue, and thank you, Senator Devlin, for bringing that up, because I did talk to him about this. Here's our concern, is that if there is a felony conviction and if there is a judgment against the person and we're taking money out of their retirement account to pay back that judgment, on the face of it, we do not have a problem with that. Our concern is if later that person is found to be innocent through additional DNA testing or other means, and the judgment is set aside, there's no provision to make that person whole in their retirement. And so we would suggest that the committee think about putting language in that would require the courts to make that person whole financially as well as legally. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. In fact, if I may, to the lawyers in the group, how does something like that get dealt with
right now?
I'm
not a lawyer, so I don't know.
I know, maybe you might not know the answer, but how does that get dealt with now, regardless of what the source of the garnishment is?
Madam Chair, could I suggest that the issue might very well be not restitution of the fine or the whatever it was that the judge is allowed to take, but rather the authority of the PERS board to put the money back, once it's been received, put the money back in the fund, that may, which I think is slightly different than what you're raising, but it's part of the same issue. I mean, does the PERS board have the authority to take money back that was wrongfully taken unless we tell them that they have the authority to do that? I don't know the answer, but I think that's an issue.
Yeah. Senator Devlin.
Even though I'm not one of the attorneys here, I would venture to say that there must be somebody actually in the Attorney General's office that knows the answer to this, because there are cases in which you're going to garnish in other cases for restitution where a person on appeal, the conviction is overturned, of how that is dealt with practically when this happens. And it happens rarely, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But just when it does happen, how is it dealt with?
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative?
I'm referring only to the wrinkle. I agree with the point you're making.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about only the wrinkle of the PERS account itself. Absolutely, there's a standing law. I have no idea what it is for how you would deal with that if you took the money out of someone's bank account or something like that. But we're talking about putting money back into the PERS account. And does the PERS board have the authority to accept it back? I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Clary is going to
We have Mr. Clary from the PERS board who happens to be here, perhaps. So Mary, don't leave. Go ahead. Paul.
Chair, COTEC, members of the committee, Paul Clary, the executive director of PERS. As this proposal is written now, it doesn't involve taking money out of members' accounts. This is a garnishment of a payment that's already gone to a member. So there won't be any, you know, there was an earlier version or earlier thought of one that actually garnished somebody's account before they were in a payment status, but this is in a payment status.
It's so, distribution.
Yeah, it's a distribution, pension payment, lump sum, or other distribution.
Okay.
So I think that concern is taken care of.
Madam Speaker, I think that answers the concern I raised because, of course, the money would simply go back then to the defendant who was acquitted, finally by the appeals court.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mayor.
I agree that that's the issue. I think that the bill is silent on that resolution. In a case where somebody was later found or the innocent or the judgment was set aside, there is no provision here to make that person whole after the money has been taken from their benefit.
Well, I think, sure. Oh, yes, Representative.
I'm just thinking about how this relates to ordinary garnishments. I think it's within the inherent authority of the trial court where the judgment is entered in the first place to then modify the judgment if it comes back on appeal and the conviction is set aside. So, in other words, whatever power exists at the court in current law would apply equally here.
Yeah, right.
I think it's within the inherent authority of the court.
Right.
I think I'm satisfied as long as we have it clearly on the record.
And we could also ask Legislative Council on that particular
issue.
That would
be really helpful.
Marisa stepped out to attend another meeting, but we will add that to the list of things to clarify.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
And I don't believe we have any other testimony on 862. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 862. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. And colleagues, this from previous LCs was LC 5-3 that we introduced as a committee bill this morning. We didn't have this last week in front of us, and so we have Mr. Taylor here with us. If you'd like to join us, Chuck Taylor is with Legislative Council, who will walk us through the bill, and then we will open up for public testimony on Senate Bill 863. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. Members, for the record, I am Chuck Taylor, Legislative Council's office. And since we have gone through a lot of this, and you have seen Senate Bill 633A from last session, I will be very brief on my comments. The new bill differs in just a couple of respects. The title has been changed slightly to make sure that we do not have any constitutional problem with exceeding the scope of the title. Section 1, as I mentioned the other day, adds Sections 2 and 3 into a series that is administered and enforced by the State Department of Agriculture. So they will be the ones who are actually going to be overseeing the implementation of the section. So I would expect that they will have some rulemaking to do to kind of flesh out the language in the bill and fill in any gaps and kind of make sure that everyone understands what is or isn't permitted. Section 2 is the prohibition itself. As I mentioned the other day, what it prohibits, Section 2 are the findings and declarations, which should give some guidance to both the department and any courts in interpreting what the legislature is trying to do. Section 3 is the prohibition section. And it prohibits enactment or enforcement, which means it affects both future and existing laws. And as I mentioned the other day, is directed to those provisions to inhibit or prevent production. And I'm interpreting to indicate purpose, either express purpose or as evidenced by the effect. Subsection 3, Section 3 is the exception that I spoke about with Representative Barnhart the other day, where it doesn't impact the local government's property itself, the ability of the local government to control its own property, so it isn't going to affect community gardens or anything of that type. Section 4 is an exception for county measures that were proposed and qualify for placement on the ballot of a county on or before January 1st, 2013, and that were approved by the electors of the county at an election held on May 20th, 2014. The thing that I would point out about that section is that it is specific to the measure. It does not exempt a county per se. So if a county were to, if the proposal were to fail at that particular election, a county is not going to be able to bring it up again and still qualify for an exemption. They are not going to be able to pass other measures simply because they have this one that is exempted. They're not going to be able to amend the measure because it has to be the measure that was qualified and was approved. So it's a purely a one-time shot. Then Section 5 has an emergency clause making the bill effective on its passage. Questions?
Questions for Mr. Taylor. Senator Burdick.
At risk of opening up the red herrings or cans of worms, depending on your point of view, I just wanted to say that some work has been put into this since we had our hearing, and we had a vigorous discussion at our previous hearing. And my clear understanding now is that Legislative Council has reviewed a variety of local regulations and determined that SB 863 would not preempt local regulations on nuisance vegetation or city tree regulations because those ordinances are not specific to the production of agricultural crops. And I'm pleased that that interpretation has been made, because regardless of where you stand on this bill, it's certainly not any of our intent to supplant rules regarding tree planting or removal in cities or local regulations of nuisance, noxious, or invasive species.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
Other questions? Mr. Taylor, the definition of local government in here is what? ORS 174.116.
Chair Kotek, it is referring, I believe, to 174.116. And I did check the other day, a school district is not included within that definition.
Thank you. And then another question I would have is, in your testimony the other day, because there are various assorted local ordinances, that you had suggested that perhaps counties or other local governments might go to the Department of Agriculture for technical assistance. And this evening you've mentioned rulemaking. I noticed when the bill the previous version, Senate Bill 633, came up during the regular session. I don't believe it had a fiscal impact from the department. And I just want to say that I don't know what legislative fiscal is doing with this bill, but it's pretty commonplace to make sure there's rulemaking and other. I just want to make sure that the department, if they're here or listening to this, I'm not suggesting that's a problem, but rulemaking usually comes with some level of fiscal, and we're on a tight timeline. I want to make sure we have all the information we need to move the bill. So I don't. I'm saying that to the world, whoever's listening. So.
They do have rulemaking authority adequate to let them do it for this bill. So there is no mention of it in the bill itself.
Thank you. Any other questions on this bill? All right, we'll move to public testimony there. Ben, thank you very much. And signed up, we have Gil Riddell with EOC and Katie Fass from the Farm Bureau. And then the next panel, we have Christy Splitt, Ivan Malisky, and Nancy Baker Croft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. On that very last point, you asked about Madam Chair, AOC was asked late this afternoon about the county fiscal impact of this bill. I was able before closing hours to contact two counties, Polk and Jackson. Both have county administrators. They were able to give me educated guess as to the cost savings. If you pass this bill, there will be no county fiscal impact. But there will be significant savings if this program were to be imposed upon a county government to implement and enforce a county ordinance of this type. And I hasten to remind you that AOC does not see this as addressing a particular kind of agriculture, preferring one kind over another. This is strictly a matter of where the regulation should take place, the county level or at the state level. That's all we think this is. I had two counties. Both were consistent in saying it will cost to implement and enforce something like this per year at least $300,000 and probably as much as $500,000. And that is because they would need to retain an expert on science and genetics of seeds, somebody who knows what this subject matter is, support staff for that person, field staff who would be trained in recognition and enforcement and means to get out into the field, an administrative procedure to deal with code violations, public information notices and the like. They will cost some. And then it's very difficult to estimate, but there's going to be lawsuits. And so that will cost as well. But the numbers I got for savings, again, at the county level per county would be between $300,000 and $500,000 a year. If this bill passed and this kind of regulation were not imposed upon a county to enforce this kind of regulation.
Thank you.
Good evening. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm also going to, for the purview of time, testify on behalf of Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Oregon Wheat Growers League, and Oregon Seed Council. Thank you for the opportunity to support Senate Bill 863. This would ensure that the agricultural seed and seed products are only regulated at the state and federal levels, preempting additional regulations by local municipalities. This would prevent a potential patchwork of different county regulations. As you heard in testimony last week, many of our members farm in multiple counties, and they operate their operations as a whole. And they need to be able to make their crop rotation decisions based on market and agronomic decisions. Adding another local regulatory framework would be a big barrier for them in terms of their operations. The issues around biotechnology are getting a lot of attention in this bill. Plant breeding, including genetic engineering, is an extremely complex process, and counties lack the financial and technical resources to regulate these products. And you've heard, nor do they want it either. This technology is an important innovation that's helping our farmers be the most productive operators in the world. It enables them to grow more crops using fewer costly inputs while significantly improving agriculture's impact on the environment and helping cope with the biggest challenges we face from nature and a growing world population. Genetic modification is not new in agriculture. Modern biotechnology is the latest of a long progression aimed at improving our plant and animal health and benefit of mankind. These crops are highly regulated at the federal level through an approval process by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, EPA, and the Food and Drug Administration. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for our... Yes. Thank you. Thank you for testifying. The next group up, we have Christy Split from the Oregon Conservation Network, Ivan Maliski from Friends of Family Farmers, and Nancy Baker Croft. And if there's anyone else interested in testifying on Senate Bill 863, could you let the administrator on the side know so we can add you to the list?
Chairs Courtney and Kotek, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Maliski, Director of Friends of Family Farmers in Molalla, Oregon. We're returning to testify in opposition to this bill, Senate Bill 863. As we testified a few days ago, there's a wide array of groups, farm groups that oppose this bill. Includes not only Friends of Family Farmers, but Oregon TILF, Oregon Rural Action, the Willamette Food and Farm Coalition, Southern Oregon's Thrive, and Rogue Farm Corps, and Organically Grown Company, which is the state's largest wholesale distributor of organic produce, a $100 million company. If anything, this bill has gotten worse since we testified in the LC last week. It's now had an emergency clause added to it, as you all know. So from our perspective, you know, this bill was designed to take away community rights to have decisions made locally around food and agriculture. And by adding the emergency clause, now we're saying that we're going to take away the rights of the voters to potentially appeal your decision to the ballot. So what we're seeing this process go backwards. We're unhappy with the way the legislature and the governor have dealt with this issue in this context. We've made that clear. We would love it if you would seriously consider some amendments. We don't think that's likely given the way that this process is weighed out, but I'll lay a couple of options out. If you're going to add an emergency clause, perhaps you should consider a sunset clause that would allow a reversion to local control if the state legislature or Department of Agriculture fails to act by sometime in 2015. Another consideration would be to remove the products of seed language. We do believe there are still problems with local measures and a case-by-case basis that may be impacted by this. To the extent that a local initiative actually requires farmers, for example, to register, like in the Hood River County Ordinance, organic farmers actually have to register, or organic backyard fruit tree growers have to register with the county. We believe the language here clearly prohibits such registration types of things to be managed at the local level. That's just one example. And I guess if now that we've added the emergency clause, we would sincerely urge you to consider taking this up in an expeditious manner in the February 2013 session and these issues. And a couple of ideas we would suggest, one would be to direct the Oregon Department of Agriculture to set appropriate precautions and safeguards to prevent GE contamination and material from spreading to nearby farmland. So that would be a farmer protection effort that you could enact. And another would be to exempt farmers from liability for inadvertently acquiring or using GE plants or seeds and some sort of a compensation program if they do. To speak very briefly to the lack of solid regulation at the federal level, I do want to flag this issue. Just last month, while the GE weed issue has gotten a lot of attention in Oregon, just last month we had the spread of a genetically engineered alfalfa to a farmer who was trying to export that alfalfa, had his crops rejected. That's a bee pollinated crop, and so that's a type of issue where you really do have pollen crossing farmer boundaries and whatnot. So I think we do need to enact some farmer protections. This bill does not do that. This bill takes away local control. It prevents communities from enacting local farmer protections, and it does so in the context of the state really doing nothing for the past decade on these issues in any meaningful manner. So thanks for the opportunity to testify. Once again, we're opposed.
Thank you.
Can you go out of order?
However order you want to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, my name is Nancy Baker Croft. I'm here ever since Thursday to try and testify to this bill. I'm glad that we're finally getting another opportunity. There was 3 pages of people, and I couldn't stay any longer on Thursday. I'm here not to represent any particular person. I'm a mom. I have a son who's really scared of GMO products. You will hardly eat anything because it's been considered something that he has no idea how dangerous it is. He has not been able to find, nor have I been able to assure him, that there's been health studies about the absolute safety of this. When I posted to people that this was necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety, people were shocked. How does this protect us? People in Oregon are more independent. I'm sure you all know that. They're mavericks. They don't necessarily wait for other people. Oregon has counties that have moved ahead. Contrary to the first testifier's explanation, there is a movement by the counties to move forward, as exemplified in this bill, that one has already done so. Three others were trying. So if we've given the state the opportunity in the 2013 session and nothing has happened statewide, why would people trust that this is going to happen anytime soon? I recommend that either the sunset clause be installed or we just forget this whole bill. I understand that you're under the pressure. I was here when Kitzhaber said I'm going to just veto the whole thing if the whole package doesn't go through. I don't think it's fair to have the health concerns of Oregonians balanced against the concerns of PERS members and students in school. It's just not a fair proposition to make. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chairs Kotek and Courtney, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Splitch. I was here on Thursday, so I'll keep this very brief. The Oregon Conservation Network, an alliance of 44 groups statewide, opposed Senate Bill 863 and any package of bills that depends on its passage. We share a concern with you and with, we hope, all Oregonians regarding school funding and funding of other really important services. But we don't believe preempting local action to protect farmers who choose not to use GMO seed has a place in a conversation about the budget. Thank you for your consideration. We really appreciate your critical thought.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate Bill 863? Not with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 861. So colleagues, the other day that was legislative concept one. This is the modification of the cost of living adjustments. And this is still the bill that was dated from last Thursday. That was the bill that we had in front of us. And I believe Marisa is... Our drafter is still in another meeting, but I was wondering if there are any questions before we take public testimony, any questions for the PERS staff on this particular bill. Does anyone need a review of the bill? All right. We will move to public testimony on Senate Bill 861. I have on the list here, I have Alana Guinea, Mary Botkin, and Peg, and I don't have Peg's last name.
Because Peg has a single name legally.
Thank you, Peg. Welcome. And then after that, we have Dennis Gabrielson, Rob Sisk, and I believe there might be some members from SEIU who want to testify, but I don't have those names. So let's start off with the first few folks, Alana, Mary, and Peg. Thank you for joining us. Whatever order you'd like to go into, just announce your name for the record, please.
Good evening, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I want to apologize that I wasn't here when you took testimony last week on this concept. You know, I know you all have heard from many of our member organizations about this bill, the other bills in this package, most of those unions in the public sector. But I'm here today because I wanted to make sure you know that this weekend our organization had its convention. And at that convention, our members voted to take a position against this bill and against PERS reform. And that vote was taken not just by public sector unions, but by private sector unions as well, people whose retirement is not in the PERS system, whose retirement is not part of the votes that you'll be taking. They voted to oppose this bill and to oppose further reform to the PERS system because they believe in retirement security, because they've seen the state move down a path in the past few years to try to expand retirement security to more Oregonians, and because they feel that this bill not only attacks retirement security, but attacks retirement security for the lowest wage workers in our state. They oppose those changes even though it's not their retirement that's on the line. So on behalf of our members, both in the public and the private sector, and especially on behalf of the few hundred of those members who are at our convention this weekend and took that vote, I wanted to make sure that we had on the record that opposition to this bill and the importance of upholding retirement security for Oregonians and looking at that long-term benefit for our state, the long-term financial security for our state by having retirement security for all Oregonians and for many of those Oregonians through a PERS system that provides a decent retirement. So we encourage you to oppose this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. I've been up here a number of times opposing this bill. Nothing has changed to change my mind or the mind of my members. I'm going to reiterate one piece of it, and that is, we have a lot of folks who are retired earning much less than $20,000 to $60,000 a year. You know, we feel sort of like the progressivity of the bill has been lost. And that in the effort to find money, we are actually punishing the lowest income, the lowest recipients of PERS. And when the legislature decides they want to have a productive discussion with us about serious problems with PERS that are identified and might be resolved, then we're ready to have that discussion. I don't think this bill reflects that serious discussion, and I don't have a lot of hope that we will have that discussion soon. But you know, if there are legitimate problems with the system that people feel need to be addressed, then we're prepared to have those talks with you. But this is not the vehicle to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kotek and members of the committee, I am a PERS retiree.
Oh, please just announce your name for the record.
My name is Peg, and as I said, it is my legal name. I am a 10-year PERS retiree. I am a proud AFSCME member, but I'm here on my own behalf. I'm a pretty average PERS retiree. My income's right about in the middle of PERS retirement. I worked 30 years for the state of Oregon. I worked very hard to get my full 30 years in. I had health problems. My last 5-6 years of work, I had to work from a wheelchair in order to get my full 30 years. I've been out 10 years. I happen to be a window retiree, and between this, that, and the other, I am within $25 of the same monthly benefit as when I retired. In other words, my income has held even for a decade. And now the proposal to make up funding for the state is to reduce my cost of living benefit, mine and all PERS retirees. And what I am asking, I truly believe that education is important. Our children are our future, and I totally support that. But I think you're taking a very deep bite out of a very narrow pie to fund. And I am getting by now, but I have great fears. If I don't have something to try and keep pace with cost of living, where I will be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, I continue to have health problems. I'm much better. I don't have to get around in a wheelchair, and I'm very happy about that. But I'm in no position to go back to work to make up for the financial hardship. And the cost of living, when it was capped at 2%, was incredibly modest. It didn't really keep up with the cost of living, but I had something to hold against the tide. This almost cuts that in half. And a few years down the road, when that compounding does not happen, will have a heavy impact. So I agree we have funding problems in Oregon. I agree we need to figure out how to support our kids, get them well educated, because they are our future. I would ask you, even though it's very late in the game, to relook at what you're asking retirees to do when we're in a position where we can't make a lot of changes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you for testifying. Next on the list, Dennis Gabrielson, Rob Sisk, and then was there anyone else who hasn't yet had a chance to sign up?
First, or
you can go first.
Oh, I'm sorry. And
oh, no.
Oh, sorry. Rob, I didn't know if you had brought anyone else with you, so.
Go. Oh. Well, I do have a lot of reporters behind me and out here around the state. For the record, I'm Rob Sisk, president of SEIU 503 OPEU, and I testified a few days ago, and I just want to reemphasize my testimony from a few days ago. As I said, I remember hearing the governor say, they earned it, they deserve it, but we need it. And I just also want to remind us that this bill affects real people who have worked hard in public service and have mapped out their lives based on a promise that was made to them. Many of these public servants are lower-wage retirees, clerical workers, custodians, groundskeepers, maintenance workers, and others. As was pointed out by one of our lower-wage workers, they count on this COLA for expenditures such as tires for their car, fuel for their car, healthcare costs that they aren't covered, such as pharmaceuticals, and even for food sometimes. Some of them currently already have part-time work within retirement. One of our members here today, for instance, was working on the census and I think does other things as well to help make ends meet. As I said earlier in my testimony, this is not only wrong, but morally wrong. It breaks a promise to workers who had counted on that promise to map their entry into retirement. I also want to mention in that context a recent article, a very compelling one in the Rolling Stone, looting the pension plans, citing that this is a large pot of money out there that is apparently now up for grabs, either by public entities to use to address budget concerns or corporations raiding it for profit, but at the loss of those who earn the pensions. Again, this is not a practice we should make an Oregon standard, especially when so many are retiring into poverty.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kotek. My name is Dennis Gabrielson. I'm a retired AFSCME employee. I'm going to start my story by saying I started work in public service in 1976. And I planned out my retirement from that date. I took a lower paying job because of the benefits. One of the benefits was retirement. Yeah, so moved forward to 2010 when I retired. So I worked extra years, so I got over 30 years in service. And I did that in order to make up for the lack of health care coverage when I retired, so I could pay for my health care coverage. But on my last COLA, the health care increase took up all of my COLA. And you might be thinking that the Affordable Care Act may come into play here. It doesn't, because I'm one of the people that is above the Affordable Care Act, so I wouldn't get a subsidy, and I would have to pay more, and I would lose approximately $20,000 in health care services because of the way the act is written. I think you guys are, I had a contract with you. If you had a contract with somebody and they reneged on it, you would file suit against them. I think we're going to be going to court over this, and I'll probably wait for the litigation because I hope you guys change your mind, but I've seen it happen in the past that you guys don't listen that well all the time, but just wanted you to know that most of the PERS employees really depend on that COLA. And that just a sidebar, I mean, the cost of living for the Portland area was not quite 2% this year. But you gave 2%, or 1 point, the COLA to the minimum wage people, whereas you're not even going to give the minimum the COLA to the people that have worked for this city, state, and counties and public entities for 30 years. The same benefit. I think that's wrong, just basically wrong.
Thank you, Dennis. Any questions for our guests? No. Thank you for being here tonight. Anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 861? Thank you for being here. Just announce your name for the record and go right in.
Madam Kotek and members of the committee, my name is Gary Steiner. I just recently retired from the city of Salem after serving 27 years. I had to recently retire because due to an injury, I wasn't able to come back to work and do my regular job. There was nothing else in the city I could do in which the city could find work for me in my particular line of enforcement. However, I want to bring to you a real-life person. When I was working, I was bringing in a wage of about $37,000. And now with PERS, I'm receiving less than $17,000 a year. It's very hard to be able to stretch the dollar to this end. My home got foreclosed. I have a disabled wife, goes in knee surgery on October 21st. There are issues, medical issues. She suffered a stroke. I'm trying to provide whatever care, medical care I possibly can, but every time I turn around, there seems to be one more issue that I can't count on. We're counting on you folks to be able to pull together and help the people to whom which you serve. Active duty members need to have the opportunity of being able to look forward to retirement as well as all of you do or looking forward to that day. And us in the fixed income position are basically our hands tied because there's only so much we can do. My wife can't work. I can't work. She does have a opportunity. She worked in private and didn't get a pension. And and she at 68 and I'm at 63. It's just, you just can't find a job out there that could go with anybody's line of work. I want to bring this issue to you because you're looking at real people. You're looking not just at the statistics. I don't know what band that you're setting up or have proposed when you took a look at the examples of what the average public servant makes. But trust me, I'm nowhere close that band. And there's lots of other my brothers and sisters that aren't close either. So I'm just asking upon your mercy to take a second look and see if there might be some other alternatives in the state budget to find the resources that we need and help protect our fellow Oregonians.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for being here. Any questions for Gary? Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
And was there anyone else who wanted to testify? Please come up.
Sorry how I look. I worked all day out in the pouring down rain.
Make yourself comfortable. Sit down. Just introduce yourself for the record.
And I'm Tina Thompson, and I've been a PERS employee for 16, 17 years. I do hard labor. I have had numerous industrial accidents. And, you know, a lot of people think, oh, the people not doing their job are the ones that are getting hurt, but it's actually the people who are going above and beyond who are getting hurt. I've had a 6x6 that was 14 feet long thrown at me by the backhoe, trashed my upper back. I had somebody drive away from a 300-pound three-point auger, hit me in the lower back while I was bent down, jammed my leg into my groin. Get written up each time. I had gotten written up each time I got hurt, even though it wasn't like I put my hand in a saw. It was like, you know, somebody did something that, you know, wasn't real cool. I restrung all the Christmas lights on Main Street, and I didn't go to the doctor because I didn't want to get written up again. And the inflammation has eaten the joints in my thumbs. I wear braces every day while I'm out there working. And I don't only work. I went above and beyond. I took care of the widows in the small town that I was working in. I would bring in crews, my son and some of his buddies, and come in and take care of the widows' houses who... The chief would call me and say, hey, Tina, is there anything you can do for these guys? Because we're going to have to violate them. And I'd bring in a crew on the weekend on my own time, and I would take care of these people so that they didn't get violated because I knew they couldn't afford it. Now, I'm going to need... Also, when I first took this job, I had a high-needs child. My son was abused by his father. And the same week I took my job with the city, I was offered a plumbing apprenticeship. I took my position so that I could take care of my son because I needed the insurance and I needed the retirement. I've been fired after 16 years, and now I've started over at the bottom. I don't have insurance, and I'm busting butt. I'm still in PERS, but I am busting butt every day. I wear braces on my hands, and I know that when I retire, I'm going to need every nickel I have just for my co-pays, okay? And I'm not, you know, I'm not asking for nothing that I wasn't promised. You know, I gave up a lot. Because, you know, I know me. I'm a doer. I would have had a company. I would have had a business. I would have, you know, been able to go out and be a plumber. And I just know me because I work hard. It doesn't matter what I do. But, you know, I feel like I've earned every nickel that has been put away for me. And I'm a tier two. So that means for several years, I got nothing because Tier 1 got something. And the day that the governor took office, I don't see him here today, I had a packet on his desk the day he took office for budget reform. I was going to Chemeketa, and I did a project on budget reform, and it outlined how we could save some money. And then I also gave one to, I believe it was Ron Wyden. I gave him a copy of it. He said he'd get back to me, too. I haven't heard nothing from anybody. There are options out there. You know, people can do something other than take away what's been promised to us. I mean, and I know that there's some slackers out there because I've worked with some, okay? But for the most part, you know, we're good, hardworking people, and we're given... I give 120% every day that I go to work. And, you know, I just think that I deserve what I was promised. You know, you can't... you know, you can't take, it's like, you know, we're going downstream, and there's a boat over there, and here's a boat here. You can't push me in that boat in the middle of the stream. You know, you can fix it maybe for the people coming down the stream after today, but you can't shove me in that boat as we're going down the stream. It just ain't going to happen. And if it does, you guys need to come with me in that boat, okay? And it's a fact. Because, and the governor, everybody, you know, and there's a lot of waste in government. I know there is. I see it every day, especially when I was in the small city. You know, huge waste. And, but, you know, nobody's holding anybody accountable. But it shouldn't come off of our backs, the employees, the people who are out there doing their jobs every single day. And so that's all I have to say. But, you know, there are other options, and you can talk to Kitzhaber because I know that I had a packet on his desk. And if anybody would be interested, I can, you know, print you guys out a copy of it. And, you know, some of it's harsh, you know. But, you know, I see when I go to Winco, I see, you know, people swiping their Oregon Trail card and buying beer just because they have money on it. Are you kidding me? My neighbors have every cable channel available to them, plus the sports channel, all the movie channels, and their kids are all getting the Oregon Health Plan. I work my butt off. I spend $40 a week on groceries, and I have basic cable. So I'm, you know, I'm living within my means, and I think that everybody needs to live within their means, especially the people who are taking money out of my pocket. You know, they shouldn't be buying cigarettes. They shouldn't be buying alcohol. If they have any more than basic cable, it comes off the top. It's just, and somebody says, well, you know, it's choices. You made the choice to live within your means, and they're making the choice to use our money and live without of their means. Well, I'm sorry. There's enough people who are computer programmers who are out of work. You guys can set up a few check stands at Winco. The SNAP goes through there, and you're only buying necessary things. And then when you're swiping your card or when they're getting their check, it goes through Comcast. I mean, this is the age of technology. You check Comcast, you check the cell phones. There's any more than one cell phone to the household, because that's all I have. And I've got a 21-year-old boy who just now is getting his own phone because he's working. But he did not have a phone.
Can you wrap up? Just cause.
Okay. Anyway, there are things that can be done, and somebody just needs to be firm about it and do it. But please don't take it out of our pockets.
Thank you, Tina. Thanks for being here. And thank you for your service as well as all the other public employees. We really appreciate that and appreciate you. Other testimony on 861? Thank you for joining us. Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Eva Corbin, and I am a former state employee of 35 years, and I retired in 2010, but I worked another year for the state because I'm a good guy, you know, until 2011. My concern is that I'm at, of course, the higher end because I went through the progression of promoting and having a job that affected many of the labor folks that are in this audience. And one of the things that I find outrageous is that you take one segment of a group that's a participant in the PERS, and you say you're deserving of this amount of money, even though the 2% was deserving of all of the state workers. And to say that the 2% is no longer in place, rather you're going to get something less than the cost of living. And cost of living goes up each year. It doesn't reduce. And therefore, you're going to not only affect the lower income workers, but you're going to affect everyone that's a participant of the PERS by lowering their income over time. And therefore, creating other potential problems with relying on other resources that are provided by the state rather than to continue to use what they are deserving of over time with the increases that are in place currently. So to say that the lower worker is more affected than the other workers that are also a participant in that program is very wrong. You don't bifurcate a system and say, you get this, but you're not deserving of that same amount of money. And to me, that's just blatantly wrong to try to say you're different. How are they different? They're the same human beings that were part of the same program. And so I urge you to take a look at the impact that this is going to have over time and what impact it will have on the programs that you would put in place later on that I may or may not be a participant in. But at least I think another look at the impact over all of the same people that worked for you and for the citizens of the state of Oregon and treat them all the same, not different. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Eva. And with that, please just introduce yourself for the record.
My name is, my name is Linda DeLucia. I am an SEIU retiree. I am also the vice president of the Alliance for Retired Americans. What I'd like to say is I don't have a hard luck story for you. That's not what I came to say. What I'm very concerned about is this article in the Rolling Stone and by David Sirota about this plan where in various states it's a scheme of the 1% to give so many tax breaks that the state becomes essentially non-fiscal. There's not enough money to run the state. And they then blame the public employees' retirement system for this, and they come after their pensions. And as I was reading this, I saw our governor. This is what our governor is doing. This is what it looks like to us. And as a former administrative law judge, what I can say is I would find this corruption. I would call it corruption. And should you allow this governor to pull you in the direction that he wants to not let business get their fair share, pay their fair share because you need two more votes, is not right. When you passed Senate Bill 822, I was a Democrat. I am no longer a Democrat. I am not a Republican, God forbid. But I am also not a Democrat. And I am starting to look for who else really represents average people, because you folks are not doing it. Senator Farioli, I want to say one thing to you in conclusion. When you came in here, you were the biggest smiling face up there. You had a great smile on your face.
Thank you.
It's because you, and I am sure that you and the rest of your caucus is laughing all the way to the bank. As people told their stories here, that smile went away. It got harder and harder for you to smile. Okay? What you're doing here in order to protect the wealthy, the richest Oregonians, is you're throwing everybody else under the bus. You find the two votes so that some kind of fair settlement can be reached. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 861. Now reach the time at which we can take up House bills, and we will start off with House Bill 3601 and then move on to House Bill 5101. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3601. Colleagues, this is the draft. This is the bill that was LC3. We have not taken any time to thoroughly go through this because it was still in the works when we met last week. And I believe we have Mr. Warner here with us, who's going to walk us through the bill, and then we will take testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul
Warner,
joined
by the whole shebang.
Since we only have one revenue bill, you get three economists. So, Chris Allenack and Mazen Malik from Legislative Revenue Office. So,
thank you all for being here.
Members of the committee, I have made available an updated chart on the revenue impact estimates that should be on the OLIS. And that chart is numbers that you're familiar with from the meeting on Friday. There's only one minor change to that. But the difference is what the chart does is it connects the revenue impact estimates to the sections of the bill that you now have before you. So that would allow you to track through that. And I'll go through that with the committee very quickly, and then if there are questions, we can certainly go into as much detail as you'd like. The first section, Section 1, addresses the issue around the corporate net corporate income tax and changing that threshold to which the 7.6 applies from $10 million down to $1 million. And that is will generate about $74 million for the general fund in combination with the rainy day fund allocations. If you look on your chart there, the...
colleagues, we are getting copies if you don't have it, okay. So
what the chart shows is those general fund impacts, including the dedicated funds for mental health, and then below it shows the rainy day fund allocations, an issue that Senator Devlin had raised last week. So Section 2 is the personal exemption credit. It shows the threshold which the personal exemption credit will be disallowed. Remind you that the threshold are 200,000 joint filer, 100,000 single filer. It also goes through the senior medical deduction reform. The three elements to it, Sections 3 through 5, convert the deduction into a subtraction, go through the caps of 1,800. It's per eligible taxpayer, so a couple. They're both age eligible and income eligible as a joint filer would get up to $3,600 as a subtraction amount. That subtraction cap is phased down until you get over $200,000 for a joint filer, $100,000 single filer. You're not eligible for the senior medical deduction. And again, I'll emphasize that this in no way affects our connection to the federal tax code, affecting the floor at which people can deduct their medical expenses on their Schedule A. The next section, Section 6, addresses the tax treatment for the interest charge domestic international sales corporation, known as the ICDISC. We adjusted those estimates in the out years when we saw the language that you see that became 3601. Initially, there had been a proposal to open up for ICDISC in the future in 2018, new ICDISC. What this language does in Section 6 is that it restricts the lower corporate tax rate to ICDISC that have been formed on the effective date of the bill, which presumably would be right around January 1st of 14. And then it just keeps that restriction in place, so the revenue impact in the out years is relatively flat, because it's limited to existing ICDISCs. 6A is the earned income tax credit. That is increased in a straightforward manner from 6 to 8% of the federal credit. That's effective 1/1/14. The revenue-raising measures in the income tax are effective 1/1/13. So there is different applicability dates for those components. Those are laid out in Section 7. Sections 8 and 9 of the bill go through the corporate income tax and allocations with the rainy day fund. In the first 4 years, 2013 through 2017, any corporate income tax revenue resulting from a rate above 7.5%, so that would be 0.1% for those net corporate income filers above $1 million, that 1/10 of that percent goes to the rainy day fund. We expect that to generate about $20 million, or about $10 million for the biennium. And that would be in place for 15-17. And then beginning with the 2017 corporate tax year, that rate drops to 7.2. So in other words, anything above 7.2% goes to the rainy day fund. That's why you see a big jump from $10 million to $54 million in 17-19. That's the result of that taking a bigger share of that corporate revenue above $1 million. Sections 10 through 13 deal with the election for the separate tax rate for the active Schedule E income. It goes through and defines some terms that you had questions about last Friday, in particular about eligibility requirements, spells out the material participation requirement. It's expressly limits this to Schedule E filers, meaning you're a subchapter S corporation or a partnership that has Schedule E pass-through income and non-passive pass-through income, as is shown on the tax form that people have to file. It goes through and defines what counts as an employee for purposes of eligibility. Each eligible taxpayer must have at least one full-time employee. Full-time is defined as minimum of 1,200 hours for the year, and only weeks in which an employee is 30 hours or more will count toward that limit. So in other words, that's what's defined as full-time, is 30 hours or more and 1,200 hours in aggregate for the year for to meet that eligibility. You can see also that the Schedule E rates are laid out in the section, Section 11B lays out those rates. And then there is a Section 13 that goes through and specifies a checking of those rates and the revenue that come through in the future. And that's laid out in terms of specific dates in Section 13. What that says is that we will have 2 years of revenue of tax return data based on the new law, 15 and 16. We will have that in the summer of 18. We will know what those two full years are. We will base this estimate on a ratio of this eligible the revenue loss we expect from this eligible income as a ratio to total income. So we'll have that ratio, and we can look back and see how much was collected as a ratio. If the revenue loss exceeds our estimate for those 2 years by more than 25%, the rates that show up in Section 11 will be automatically adjusted proportionally. The top rate, the 9.9, will not be changed, but all the other rates will be adjusted to recapture the revenue. In other words, to true up the estimate for 15-16, what rates would it have taken to bring that revenue loss down to what was expected, what was projected? So those rates would then automatically adjust based on that calculation and would apply to the 2019 tax year. There would be one more calculation in the bill. That would be 4 years later. It would be done in 2022 for the 2023 tax year. The difference, it would be the same calculation. In the initial calculation, the rates cannot drop below the original rates set in the bill that you see. So they can't be lowered in that initial calculation. In the second calculation, if the rates have been raised in the first calculation, they can be lowered if the revenue loss is less than expected, but they cannot fall below these original rates. So under no circumstances can a rate be increased above 9.9%. So in other words, those rates are bounded by 7 and 9.9%, and there can be movement within that, in that first period, movement up if the revenue loss is larger than expected, movement up or down in the second checkpoint, depending on where the revenue is compared to the estimate. So that's specified, and the Department of Revenue will carry out that estimate in conjunction with us in legislative revenue. The next section goes into the cigarette tax allocation of new revenue. There's a 13-cent increase in the cigarette tax effective January, 91 days after you sign EDI for the special session. We have put in a floor tax. Language is in that section as well. The floor tax is an inventory tax, so that those cigarettes that the distributors have in their inventory, they'll have to pay a floor tax based on the higher rate that's in effect, the 13-cent higher rate. The rate goes to 14 cents, or 14 cent increase in 1116, 15 cents in 1118. So in terms of cigarette tax rates, it'll be $1.31 on 1114, $1.32 on 1116, and then $1.33 on 1118. Those sections also allocate the revenue. 10 cents from the cigarette tax is allocated to mental health in the 14-15 calendar years, and 3 cents to the general fund. Once the change in 16 takes place to a 14-cent rate, the entire 14 cents goes to mental health. And in 2018, the entire 15 cents also goes to is dedicated to mental health in that section. The remaining sections, there's a standard language that we use when we go back and adjust income tax laws during a year, is that we waive penalties and interest for underpayment. So the department is allowed to do that if the underpayment is caused by the change in the law. And there's some rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue, and effective dates are in the last section. Section 26 would be 91 days after sine die. There can be no emergency clause on the bill for regulating taxation. So that's our summary, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Paul. And I think everyone has the chart now as well. So, colleagues, this is a really important bill, so I want to make sure we have time to answer all the questions that are here. So we have experts ahead of us here. Questions? We'll wait to make sure you don't have any questions. Normally, we have a lot more time to look at these things, and if we're going to make any amendments, that will happen in the morning. So, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm getting to that amendment question. I understand that the department may have some technical suggestions for us. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we have shared the LC draft with the Department of Revenue. They made a series of suggestions. They are very technical in nature. We have a couple of two. One relates to these. The language in here needs to be have a technical adjustment to reflect part year and non-resident income, which is standard language we use in an income tax change. So those amendments are all technical in nature, and we wanted to get those in one amendment.
Thank you. And when will we have that?
Madam Chair, we should have them as soon as we can in the morning.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Bill, and I'm trying to find it again, looks like on the bottom of, on the draft that I have, LC3, bottom of page 23, we're moving the period for rates of taxation applicable to moist snuff. And this, would you first remind us what this change is, and give us a sense of what this change in date is likely to do to the revenue for the tobacco taxes?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'd like to refer to Mazen Malik. He's done a lot of work in this area.
Madam Chair, for the record, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. Representative Barnhart, the current law has an escalator of about a quarter of a percentage point of the CPI that will come into effect in 2019. This would be page 24, and that's line 5. That is pushed from 2019 to 2022. And the base of the CPI was 2017, now it's 2020. What would do to the amount of revenue is approximately about I think $280,000 per year or something like that. Reduction. For that 2-year period. So you have that amount less.
But could I follow up?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I'm wondering how confident you are of these numbers, given that the results for the last change that we made actually was substantially higher than the estimates that you had. Can you give us any comments about that?
The last when we changed this, Representative Barnhart, the thing that made the most difference in the estimate is having the floor for the moist snuff. So you can't go below a $2.14 per container. That, in essence, represents about 71 to 72% of the revenue of all OTP. And that, in essence, have created a new atmosphere. And once that stabilizes for the last 3 years or so, we have enough data on it. We have a pretty good idea of how things are coming in the revenue section.
Well, if I could
follow up. Representative.
So what I understand, and forgive me if I've misunderstood it, because I very well may have, that the estimate of some period around that change, the base rate based on weight, but a minimum amount, I think is what you're referring to, that your estimate was in the range of $5 million accumulated, when the actual amounts turned out to be about $30 million. Am I even vaguely close on that? And can you tell us how this proposal would affect that issue, if at all?
The Representative Baja, the growth in the moist snuff and how what kind of data that we had at that time was based on the industry and on the things that we were trying to estimate out of base that basically was based on price. The change that happened with the moist snuff is that we went to a weight base, so it's the per unit, and it changed the regime of the tax, if you will. That in itself kind of clarified, gave us a new way of looking at the data. It just now, all of a sudden, we have a lot more real data that we can look and see. So if it was based on sales that is reported or not reported at that time, so things basically have improved a lot, and we have a lot better data to do. So we have an ability to look at a lot more concrete things. However, as you know, the CPI might or might not be as severe as a forecast would be, a quarter of the CPI and what it's based on. So even the escalator, it is based on future circumstances that might or might not occur. It is a forecast after all. And the forecast, you know, as good as the data that it is based on. So as the database that we are dealing with, it seems to be about $285,000 to $300,000 a year is probably a good estimate.
Thank you. I want to switch to a different topic. Maybe other people have questions on this.
Yeah, let me go to Representative Parrish. Is there anyone on the Senate side that had? Okay, Representative Parrish, then we'll come back to you. Representative
Parrish. Just a really quick question on the cigarette tax with the money going to mental health and the numbers that are over here. And you've got 10 cents in this 2014-15 to mental health. I didn't realize 3 cents was going to the general fund. Do you have a better kind of breakout for what those numbers then kind of net look out to be, that how much will be going to mental health in 2014-15? How much of that represents the general fund?
Representative Parrish, the amount going to the general fund is about 20 million. I believe it's between 20 and 21 million. So the remainder is what would be going to the general fund. Okay. But I can get a more precise number for you.
So hold on.
But they summed to the 27.
I think he has it backwards.
I think you have it backwards. 20 million.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's 20 to 21 to mental health, and the remainder to the general fund. Sorry.
Be the 7 million, but then in the subsequent years, then that is all strictly going to mental health. So then the rest of the numbers across the 32, 31, 29, 28, that would all be mental health dollars.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I want to go back to the section, I think it's 13. I think I'm wrapping my head around this process of figuring out what the future rates will be for section 11. I guess it is section 11. It is section 13 that I'm talking about, the triggers. How confident are you that the department is actually going to be able to generate the numbers from which these ratio changes will be, or these ratios can be derived, from which you will derive the new rates, or that they will derive the new rates. What's your level of confidence that they can actually do that in a way that will make this activity purely administrative and therefore not violate the separation of powers requirement that the legislature is the one that writes the law?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnard, I'll try to address that, then I'll ask Chris if he wants to add to that, because he's very familiar with the data that's available for this. The one thing I want to point out is that the ratio is to total income, so it's not going to be a direct estimate or a direct comparison of our revenue estimate. It's going to be what we built in our assumption, which will be laid out when we made the estimate. What percentage of tax of total income did we assume would be this eligible income? So the Department of Revenue will be, they will have to collect the data on this eligible income, because after all, they're taxing at a different rate. So they'll have to have a data process that collects that data and says exactly what that is, and then we will know what revenue is generated from that from those that take this election and use the lower rates. So we'll have hard data on what the revenue that's generated from that income, and they will report what that income is, and we'll know what total income is as a matter of course. That's just basic from their data. So I'll ask Chris if he wants to add to that.
Representative Barnhart, I guess the only thing I would add is that the information are the tax returns for, in this first round, tax years 2015 and 2016. And so that is the reason for the
Chris,
delay.
Chris, could you just introduce yourself?
Chris Allenag, Legislative Revenue Office. The source will be the tax returns for 2015 and 2016. And we won't have, with the delay in filing the returns and extensions and so forth, that's why we won't have those returns until mid-2018. And the calculation will be fairly administrative at that point, because they will just look at those returns and they have the ability to model what the tax would have been without this provision of law.
633.
Okay. Could I follow up?
Absolutely.
I'm looking at the end of sub 2 sub A, which is on the LC draft 3, lines, I think, 25 through 29. Since I don't have the engrossed bill, I don't know any way other way to describe it. Of page 18. What I think this does, if I understand it correctly, is that it requires the department to adjust the rates proportionally to generate the revenue sufficient to compensate for the additional revenue loss or gain, but no more than the 9.9% top rate or lower than the original rate in this bill. The question I have is, does this allow them to change the income ranges or simply the rates within those income ranges?
Representative Barnhart, this is a change, just a change to the rates.
The rate.
Not the brackets.
And what does the word proportional mean in this situation? I'm trying to get specific here in case there's an issue later of legislative intent.
Representative Barnhart, I think the word proportional would apply to the rate itself. So if you were to change the 7.1 rate by 10%, you'd change the 7.2 rate by 10%.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that answers my questions on this section. I may have some on others.
Representative McLean, would you like to jump in and I'll go back to Representative Barnhart? I'm happy to.
No, go ahead.
Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure I understand your last question. If you have a trigger that requires adjustment of the rates when the amount exceeds 25%, then if you have a 10% increase in revenue, why would you then adjust the rates at all? I thought there was a 25% leeway there. Did I mishear you?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, yeah, I wasn't referring to 10% there. I'm just saying that once you do this calculation, you would say, okay, we need to raise X amount of revenue. So you'd have a proportional increase in those rates, each of which would generate a certain dollar amount to get you to fill that gap. So let's say that you're outside the 25% and the revenue loss above the estimate was $50 million. So you take that $50 million and you would find out what proportional increase in the rates would generate $50 million. So in most cases, you're probably talking about a tenth of a percent at most to generate that kind of revenue.
Follow-up? Just to make sure I understand, I mean, the way I read the bill, there is a the adjusting of the rates only triggers if the for the purposes of this, a revenue loss exceeds 25%. Correct?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, the mechanism here works like the 2% kicker, that there would be a trigger. The 25% is the trigger. And once you trigger that, then you would calculate what it would take to bring you back to the estimate. So if it's 24% over, there's no adjustment. If it's 26% over, you do a full adjustment to bring you in line with the estimate.
Just follow up to make sure I understand. So 24%, no adjust to rates. 26% to adjustment of rates, or 26% adjustment of rates?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, that's what the calculation would be. It would show the ratio would show you how much revenue you needed to bring you back in line with the revenue estimate. And then you would go back in and apply the rates. You do it historically, but you can apply it going forward. You would go back to that previous period and calculate, well, what would the rates have needed to be, proportionally changing them, what would they have needed to be to generate what the estimate was?
And that's how this is currently written.
That's correct, Representative McLean. That's how it's calculated. And it's, as I said, it's a two-time adjustment. And in the second period, is different than the first, because you can actually go down in those rates if your revenue loss is less than expected, but cannot go below what these rates that are in the current bill are.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Paul just answered my question. The rates are hydraulic up or down based on the revenue estimates and whether or not we hit those targets. And his response answered my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
This discussion has prompted a question to me. So on page 18 of LC3 online, 6 and 7, we talk about the 25%. So you referenced the kicker, Paul. What's the estimate fluctuation that we use for the kicker? Is it 25%?
Madam Chair, the estimate, the range we use is 2%.
Where did the 25% come from? Is it based on anything?
Madam Chair, I think this just grew out of the discussions. I don't know of a specific reason for that percentage amount.
You think a range of 5 or 10% would probably be more prudent?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's a policy call, and the rate that is chosen, it's a policy decision. Obviously, the lower the range, the more you're guarding against risk that revenue loss exceeds the estimate. So it's a risk aversion technique. So that if this estimate, and keep in mind again that this is focused on schedule income above what we thought is proportion of income. So it's not necessarily a dollar estimate. It's we have more schedule income as a percentage than we anticipated. So that's what it's designed to counter. The more narrow the range, obviously, the more protection there would be to revenue loss exceeding what the estimate is based on that ratio.
And my understanding is that, you know, because of we want to have a couple years of tax returns to understand the activity within this that could be generated by the new rates, and that by the third, you know, rates could readjust in 4 years. So, for example, they could be adjusted up 40, 50 million for 3 years in a row, and then the rates get adjusted. And what would, and that revenue increase that is past the projection, would we recoup that in any way?
Madam Chair, what we would the estimate would not go back and recoup the past dollars, but it would establish a rate structure that would bring the future estimate in line with this original estimate. In fact, the way the language is written here now is you would use the same estimate we do now, that same ratio. You wouldn't change that in 2022. You would still use that. And then, so those rates would bring you in line with that ratio going forward, but it would not go back and recapture the dollars that we underestimated in the past.
Thank you, Paul. Representative Barnhart, did you have any? Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to follow some logic here. The 2% kicker. What is that number applied to in terms of a revenue estimate? Is that the entire general fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, the kicker now under Measure 85, the corporate and the non-corporate is calculated separately. Non-corporate is by far the larger number, of course, and that's about 93-94% of general fund. And that would be, it's not only personal income taxes, but it's all other non-corporate general fund revenue.
So if you were to translate, Madam Chair, if I could follow, if you were to translate that into a dollar amount, not a percentage, that would be 94% of the total general fund, $14 billion.
Senator, that would be close.
So 2% of $14 billion is a pretty reasonable but very large real number. And if I were looking at the 25%, would that be of the $27 million estimate of revenue?
Senator Farioli, the 25% you would apply to those revenue estimates that are on your chart. So, for example, for 2017-2019, it would be 25% of the 239, which would be about $60 million.
Of $60 million. Okay, I guess, Madam Chair, if we're going to look at ratios, I don't know if 2% kicker is a good comparator to 25% trigger.
Thank you, Senator. But just to follow up on that, so we'd have potentially $60 million, $60 million, $60 million for three tax collection years in a row before the rates would readjust if it was above that?
Madam Chair, the $60 million was the biennial figure, so it would be times two in terms of four straight years in which we're outside that range.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I want to stay on this topic for a little bit. Do we have a definition on line four? You have used the words actual total income in this state. What is that number? How do we derive that actual total income in this state? Or is it in the bill, or is it defined somewhere else? Or what do you expect those words to mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that concept is taken from the tax returns, and on the federal 1040, and again we're tied to federal law, so on the federal 1040, all of the sum of components of income is referred to as total income. So the concept of actual total income would be for full year tax returns for 2015 and 2016, the amount reported on that line for the federal form.
Okay, could I follow up on that topic? This disturbs me quite a bit because I think that term could be defined in a whole number of different ways. It may not matter a whole lot if you always use exactly the same definition. I mean, I could read that term to be all the income in the state by everybody. If, as long as that's the definition you use and if you can actually derive that number, then using that as your denominator would be fine. The numerator, very small by comparison, but the ratio if issues would be the same. I would respectfully submit that the term actual total income in this state is not what you just said. It's something else. If you mean actual total income on 1040 income tax returns, then I think you ought to say that. And again, as I say, if you use the same definition every time you do the calculation, it may not matter which one you use, but I think the more specific we get, the less likely we are to have a court tell us, no, you can't delegate that authority because you haven't defined it carefully enough.
We're getting down to the blues right now.
If I could, Madam Chair,
I don't mean to be argumentative, but I'm very concerned that we actually can use this mechanism in case these numbers turn out to be significantly different than we expected, and that's the reason I have these many comments. And if I could ask a different question, then,
Representative Barnhart, I never find your thoroughness argumentative. Please continue.
Thank you. I appreciate that. This 25%, we're talking about a ratio which is a very small number, isn't it? Let's assume for the sake of argument we're talking about, what, 1%, 2%, or something smaller than that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's on the order of a tenth of a percent.
A tenth of 1%. So 0.001. Yes? 1/1,000th.
Yes.
Okay. So an increase of 25% in that number would be 0.00125. And in this case, we're talking about a larger number than that, so let's make it 126. That's what 25% means in this case, isn't it? Doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if that helps the chair's question or not, but it certainly helps me understand what the number means.
Thank you, Representative. Decimals are always a little dicey at 7:15, so thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair, we've just seen this. We're going to meet again in the morning. I hope that we'll be able to have them back in case additional questions occur to us in the middle of the night, which I suspect they will.
There are so many one-liners at this point.
Madam Chair.
Happy to make that happen, Representative. Yes.
I just have one question, and because I don't sit on revenue, and our good representative who does, and he talked about definitions and usage of words, and mine is just whether or not the use of the words that you were concerned about, whether that's customary usage in the tax bill. If that's customary and it's used in other parts of our statutes, is that consistent?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I would say it is customary language. It's used by the state economist in the forecasting of the general fund revenues, and that forecast is shared with our office, and we use it in baselining our models to these to those numbers.
Thank you. Now, if you talk budget, Devlin and I are on a different page, but revenue is a little different for us down here on this end.
Yeah. If I could, Madam Chair, what I was driving at was the issue of delegation of authority.
Yeah.
And the Constitution doesn't allow us, as I understand it, to delegate our authority to the Department of Revenue. It does allow us to give them a formula that they can apply without any capacity to deviate from it. And I just want to make certain that that formula is clear enough so that some court isn't going to say later, you can't do that because you're actually defining what the legislature never defined.
Thank you, Representative. Well, I'm sure we will have you back in the morning. We'll have some technical amendment and then anything that people dream up in the middle of the night. That's helpful.
We will be here, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to move on to public testimony of House Bill 3601, and we have Arthur Towers and Katie Fast signed up. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on 3601? If so, maybe wave at me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, and I have the privilege of being the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. I don't want to testify at any great length, but simply to renew the concerns that I expressed a couple days ago around issues of income inequality and reduction in funding for services in the out biennium. I do want to build on the previous conversation and exchange. So I think a lot of good issues were raised around the issue of the sideboards. And under normal circumstances, no disrespect to the hearing that you're holding, but it makes me pine for the hearings to Senator Burdick and Representative Barnhart chair, where we vet these issues quite thoroughly. And I think that the previous exchange raised a lot of questions that I'm concerned won't be vetted quite as thoroughly as they might be given the speed at which we're going. So I'll stop there and appreciate the chance to testify and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Arthur. Katie?
Good evening again. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau supports House Bill 3601. More than 1,100 farms in Oregon have been operated by the same family for more than 100 years. And this is an example of the type of businesses that this small business tax cut is going to help. It's going to help them to be incentivized to stay in business and to expand. The Farm Bureau does have some concerns, though, with Section 11, Sub 6, Sub C, which places the hours of work requirement on it for employees. Our concern not lies with the aggregate number of 1,200, but with the 30-hour work week requirement. In a total, farms across Oregon have different employee standards and employment mix. That's a mixture of full-time and seasonal work, depending on the operation. And work schedules are based when the crop is ready and when the work needs to be done. And we have a concern that there will be legitimate farms that will meet the total work hour but will not make the 30-hour per week employee hour because of the nature of their business. There are some weeks where you work well over 30 hours, and other weeks, due to weather like this, you work less. And so that is a concern that some legitimate farms would be exempted out of the small business tax reduction. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions or give any clarification.
Thank you, Katie. Actually, I want to, if I could address your comment on the employee hours. You know, it is complicated to draft what a full-time employee would be to try to make sure you encompass as many work arrangements as you can. And maybe this is a question for legislative counsel, who I'm not sure is in the room at the moment, on this particular issue, that in that case, let's say someone worked 45 hours a week because of the seasonality of the weather. All 45 hours of that week would count because it's over the 30. But if they worked 20 hours a week, you couldn't count that 20 towards the total. That's how I'm reading this.
Representative Kotek, that's our understanding as well, and that's where our concern lies, is that during the harvest months or planting months, there'll be long hour weeks. But in the winter time, there is just not the work to be done, and they can't suspend the full-time activity. And so that week requirement doesn't work well for agriculture, but the aggregate number of 1,200 hours we can support.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. On this topic, I want to make certain that I understand this section correctly, and I'm looking at page 17, lines 10 through 15. I think those are the places that part you're referring to. And the way I read that, and then backing up three lines to include 7 through 9, the way I read that, it doesn't necessarily refer to one worker. It could be any number of workers who, if any of them individually work 30 hours that week, that 30 hours counts. If you have 15 workers working the harvest for 2 weeks, each of them working 40 hours a week, you get to count 15 times 40 times 2 toward that 1,200 hours. That's the way I read this section. So you might accumulate all 1,200 hours in a two-week harvest period with a number of workers and not employ anybody the rest of the year. Does that change your view at all of as you testify about this issue?
Speaker Kotek, Representative Barnhart, I don't believe so. That's our understanding of how it's drafted. We're looking at this where, you know, we represent members that have a larger workforce that will bring in those 15 workers for harvest and others that will bring in, you know, 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And so looking at it, that it is really impacting and assisting the businesses that I think you all want to help that are employing workers throughout the state, and trying to get a mix that works well for our family farms, I think, is important.
Representative McLean?
Just to comment on what Representative Barnhart indicated, I think to make that on page 17, line 15, what it would need to say is a week in which one or more workers works at least 30 hours may be considered. And if it said that, then I think Representative Barnhart's view would be accurate. But
it doesn't.
Right now it doesn't say, and I think what we're hearing is this is a problem for agriculture.
Madam Chair, I think that would be a great question for LC, but because I don't read it that way.
Well, maybe they'll hear us and come back.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions for the panel? Thank you for testifying. And we have two more individuals on House Bill 3601, Jody Weiser and Ross Dondero.
A worker works.
Is there anyone here, anyone else here to testify on 3601? Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. On page 13 of the bill, the ICDISC program is discussed. And in reading the bill, we wonder what the justification is for reducing any taxpayer's tax rate to 2.5%. The tax rate in the various brackets that we have are 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. The tax rates for corporations are 6.6 and 7.6. So where did 2.5% come from? It behooves us to think that there would be some taxpayers whose taxes on a portion of their income would be reduced to so little as 2.5%. And we wonder how the justification for that came. We also wonder why, we understand that you're trying to keep people from creating ICDISCs who don't currently have ICDISCs, but in the process of writing a legislation that says you have to have been an ICDISC by January 1st, you're actually creating a situation where the farmer who comes along and starts growing filbert trees next year and starts harvesting nuts in 5 years or whatever the period of time is for filbert trees, they are going to have to not have the advantage of the 2.5% rate that current farmers would have, and that doesn't seem fair at all either. Plus, the whole idea, I think, flies in the face of all taxpayers should be treated the same. And the ICDISC is for those people who export their product out of the country. It's hard for us to see any reason why the wine grower that sells his wine to the vintner who sells his wine to Canada should have a lower tax rate than the one that sells it to Oregonians or to people in New York. It just doesn't, we can't see any public purpose for the state of Oregon that's being served, which brings us to the fact that there is, in none of this legislation, any place where we can see where there is a goal statement for what is attempting to be accomplished. So without a goal statement, it's really easy to kind of go off the course and not stop and say, oh, yes, that's what our goal was. That's what we were trying to accomplish. So that brings me to the second piece of this legislation to which I want to speak. So the rationale for lowering the tax rate for small businesses was that they're job creators. And yet we're talking about reducing taxes on people who have a payroll of around $12,000 a year or more. Now, as a person who has worked for a living and earned a living or has made payroll for other people who work for me, $12,000 a year does not make me a job creator. It sounds to me like if that was our goal, we wouldn't be writing law that makes it easy for us to help people who are hobby farmers instead of people who are really in the business of farming. Somebody who hires 15 people for 2 weeks of the year is not really creating jobs, sustainable living in our state. That's somebody who's here and gone and without work and looking for benefits because they don't have a standard of living that supports them. And so it makes no sense to have such a low job requirement. I think if you had the equivalent of 5 full-time employees, that might begin to make some sense. But this low standard of employment, it just shows how the measure is missing a goal statement that helps define what we're trying to accomplish. I also don't understand the logic behind benefiting people who've chosen to organize themselves as S corporations or as partnerships, but not the same kind of businesses can be organized as LLCs. So it seems again like we're treating one category of taxpayers different than the other, and yet good tax policy says that all people in the same situation should be treated the same. And the fact that you're an LLC versus an S corp is a matter of relative indifference to the state of Oregon. So I don't see, you know, they're both pass-through entities, just as the partnership is. I don't see why we're leaving that category of employee out unless we're just trying to control cost. And finally, I think that the calculation for trying to find to hold it back the cost, if it ends up being more expensive than anticipated, is pretty complicated. And it tries to keep in place the fact that we may become an ever larger small business state where everybody has to go make their own job because they can't find a job. And so that piece of our revenue may become bigger or littler depending upon what happens in that. But what we're talking about is an estimate in 2021-23 of $332 million evolving into one of 414 if you don't use the rest of the calculation. And that's almost 1,000 teachers. That's a huge number of public employees to be off by because we're doing a tax advantage for some private employers. And so I'm really worried that we're not looking at the whole picture. When we're doing this, we're just looking at dollars and trying to get a formula that will work instead of making good public policy, and that's not the way we should be. That's not how we should be acting in this building. Thank you.
Thank you.
I better keep these on. Chair Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Russ Dondero, R-U-S-S-D-O-N-D-E-R-O. I didn't plan to testify tonight. But I came down to watch the process. I'm a political science professor who's retired, but I'm in this building a lot advocating for a variety of issues dealing with human services and this last session, land use planning and environment. What I'm really, you have my written testimony because I wasn't able to be here last week on record, but I'm going to change the preamble in my written policy. I wrote that I supported the package. Even though I felt, to steal a quote from Garrison Keillor, that it's a series of badly sutured body parts. And I think you all know what I mean. There are components of this whole process designed for a good purpose, I think, to put more money into K through 12. I applaud that goal. But there's so many discordant elements that I agree with my good friend Judy Weisner that I don't see the ultimate logic of this long term. And so I'd like to reinforce what I said in my conclusion to you. And a sort of response to the woman who testified to you earlier tonight on how we can get from here to there by sort of thinking out of the box, which is my phrase. And I suggested, number one, we're all here, all of us, because of Measure 5, Measure 47, 50, and then also Measure 11. Ever since those measures passed in 1991 and then later on in subsequent sessions, we have, you know, the budget in Oregon to do human services and education, K through 12, also higher education, and all the other things we need to do has been constrained by a tourniquet, by the fiscal tourniquet. And so we've, all of you have had to sort of scurry around every session to put the pieces back together again. We're like Humpty Dumpty. And I think until we go back and have a serious discussion about how all of those measures collectively, which passed within a 5-year period of one another, have really disabled us from finding revenue sources to pursue the mission of Oregon and the legislature and the people of Oregon. We will continue to have these kinds of discussions around what I think most of you would regard in one way or the other from either political side as not necessarily harmonious, but rather discordant pieces. In 1980, Governor Victor Atiyah, who I admire tremendously, faced a situation not like ours, we faced many times in Oregon, of lowered revenue due to a bad economy. And he imposed, as you recall, an income tax surcharge, as I recall, 10%. But in the process, he also did something else, and the legislature went along with it. He abolished the unitary tax, which taxes the entire worldwide wealth of multinational global corporations located here in Oregon. I think that was a policy mistake. It prevented Measure 5 from coming from California, Prop 13, to Oregon, so we bought some time. And that really what it was all about, is trying to prevent Measure 5. I agree with Vic on that one. But in the long term, we saw Measure 5 passed. And so we didn't prevent it, but we then allowed the corporate community to come into Oregon and benefit from the cumulative impact of Measure 5 and et cetera. And now we have the problem of decompression, which we're all aware of. So I frankly think we should go back and look at the unitary tax or some variant of it and say, really, does that serve the public purpose of Oregon? I was here in this building, and I testified against the bill, which Governor Kitzhaber supported, giving Nike a 30-year reprieve from increased taxes. I think it's bad policy. I live in a county, Washington County, in which Intel and Genentech and other corporations get tremendous tax credits from what they deliver in their goods, and they get accepted from property taxes in lieu of other kinds of payments which they pay. But the net impact is that in my hometown, in the community in which I live, Forest Grove, we're still dealing with class sizes at the elementary level, which are still increasing, despite the good work you guys did last session. And parents in the last school board meeting in Forest Grove last week were very upset about what's going on. We were promised something, and it's not happening. The other part is, of course, we passed the kicker, again, to stimulate the economy and do good things. But I think the kicker, we need to think about the kicker. You know, how can we justify that when we have so many needs in this state? And then finally, I think when I heard the testimony of the public employees, it was really hard to not get emotional and say, you know, there is something just unfair about having three tiers of public employees. There's something basically inequitable about that. And we're sort of building on their backs the future, hopefully, of our kids and our future in Oregon. And I don't think that's right. You know, PERS was mismanaged, badly mismanaged, in the 1980s. We should have dealt with it then. We didn't. And we should go back and deal with it now. But let's quit penalizing the people you heard tonight testify, because that's not fair. Just for the record, I'm not a PERS employee. I'm not a PERS recipient. I'm in the private sector. I have one of the best public pension plans in the country called TIA-CREF, because I taught in the private sector. My wife, who's a public employee in Forest Grove, was not in PERS because Forest Grove opted out. So she had no pension plan, no health care plan. It was all dependent upon me. And so, you know, we don't benefit from the PERS. I wish we did. But bottom line to me is that it's equity. It's about equity. And you've got a tough job in front of you. And it's not just for this 2 or 3 day special session.
Yeah.
It's going to be 2014 and beyond. Now, the governor has promised in 2016 a tax reform package. Well, I don't even know whether the governor has been governor then. So I'm sorry. He's promised tax reform when he was here 8 years ago and never was delivered. And many of the same people who are on this tax reform package are the same people who said, well, we took the poll and we can't do it. There's no public support. Well, part of leadership, frankly, is generating public support. That's what Vic Attia did back in the day. And I expect a governor should do that, too, who's now in that slot, in that seat. And I just wish, I wish you all Godspeed. I wish you, you know, you got a tough job ahead of you. But I wish we would begin to think about solutions beyond this sort of incremental process that we're confronted with. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Representative McClain?
Just for the record, a couple things. I agree with the testimony that Vic Attia was a great governor, and I would love to see someone like Vic Attia be governor again. But the on page 17 of House Bill 3601, Ms. Wise testified that it doesn't include LLCs. It is certainly the intent of me, I believe my other colleagues, that this House bill does apply to LLCs. LLCs, from what I understand, and we can clarify with Mr. Warner tomorrow, can on single member LLCs can be taxed as a sole proprietorship or a partnership. Multi-member LLCs are taxed as a partnership. I interpret on line 7 of page 17 the word partnership, and throughout this is including entities of limited liability companies. And so I just wanted to say for the record that it is certainly my intent, and I think the intent of many of my colleagues, that this rate system contemplated by 3601 would include limited liability companies.
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes, Representative.
I appreciate that statement. We might need to hear a little bit more from counsel on this, because I think Representative McClain is right about the tax treatment, but the language in Section 11 mm-hmm. in describing who's eligible for this refers to taxpayers who have income attributable to any, quote, partnership or S corporation. And my concern would be that if we don't explicitly include LLCs in that phrase, then we may not be including it. And it's just a question for the drafters. When we come back in tomorrow, I guess.
We do have the drafter here.
Oh, okay.
Ella Rosaf has left, but the drafter is here with us, so I don't. Thank you for your testimony.
I was going to ask if it's truly a language issue. The IRS doesn't actually recognize LLC in theirs. That's a state created. So I don't know if LLC is somewhere really specific in the statute, but from a taxation perspective, if you're going to file your taxes, LLC is not. You're taxed as a partnership. So it would make sense that that's the language, but clearly if we need to add LLCs in here for clarity, then I'm absolutely for doing that.
Kate, do you want to join us? That's my understanding as well, that it's LLCs are not actually a filing status. However, you can elect to file under one of those to
the state level we need that.
Kate, we have legislative counsel with us, and we also probably want to talk about the definition of employment, too. So.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, Kate Tossel from the Office of Legislative Counsel. If I can first address the latter issue, the reason that the draft refers specifically to partnerships and S corporations is indeed that those are the filing statuses. It doesn't actually refer to LLCs because that's the corporate structure. That's the corporate entity and whichever entity would have to select a filing status, and it would be either a partnership or an S corporation. And I believe that Section 11 is accurate, and it does fulfill the intent. So I think that addresses questions as to that aspect of Section 11.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? So am I hearing you say then that a person who had chosen the LLC structure would be eligible, as you interpret this, as you believe the tax court would interpret this, to qualify for the same treatment?
Chair Kotek, Representative Garrett, yes. It refers specifically to the filing status, so I think it does. They would be eligible.
Okay, thank you.
So if I can address the question of the employment requirement in Section 11, this initially began as a requirement of one employee, and that employee would have to work 1,200 hours in a year, and would need to work, and that would be a tax year, and they would need to work at least 30 hours in tax year. In order to satisfy the intent that it could be multiple employees and perhaps seasonal employees, this is the language, I think, that fulfills that. And the last piece of paragraph C in line 10 that talks about, and this is in the introduced bill, House Bill 3601, it's on page 17 of the LC, if people are still looking at the LC3, it would require that in order to be considered toward that 1,200 aggregate hours, they would have to be a week in which that worker worked 30 hours. And I didn't catch the entire exchange earlier. I believe Representative Barnhart was discussing this, and I think that was accurate, and I think this does capture that intent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is the intent of me, and I believe other members on this committee, that page 17, lines 10 through 15, which is section 11, subsection 6, subsection C, would allow an employer to have one or more actual human beings with Social Security numbers that fulfill a requirement in total of 1,200 aggregate hours, and that weeks in which they don't have people working don't count, or maybe under 30 don't count, and you know, we may have to clarify that. But I'm a little troubled by you saying that it's a single worker, because the goal of it was to make it multiple workers. So if I had 10 workers who worked 20 hours each, that would be a week of 200 hours.
Co-Vice Chair McLean, Chair Kotek, I did not mean to state that it was a single worker. The intent of this language, as it is in the latest, the most recent draft and in the introduced bill, is it could be any number of workers and that they would be aggregated. The original language was clearly envisioned one worker. This provides, and as long as the number 1,200 is reached, there could be 40 workers who work a 30-hour week, and they could work it all in the same week, or they could work it sequentially. But the intent, and I believe the effect of this language, is that it can be as many workers as are needed to reach 1,200 aggregate hours in the tax year. But their hours in a week in which that worker works fewer than 30 hours would not count toward that aggregate number. So because they would essentially be part-time workers during that week.
All right. Then my follow-up is that it is the intent of myself, and I believe other members of the committee, that to accommodate the seasonality of companies all over the state of Oregon, whether they be in agriculture or whether they sell fireworks and the like, that as long as they have one or more people working 30 hours, that's a good week. But what I'm hearing you say is that wouldn't be a good week unless one single human being worked more than 30. So just to make sure, I want to throw out a hypothetical. If I have 10 people that work 20 hours a week each, does that count towards the aggregate of 1,200 hours?
So Vice Chair McLean, Chair Kotek, that would not count toward the aggregate. Any worker who was working fewer than 20 hours, those hours would not, as this is drafted, would not count toward the 1,200 aggregate hours. And that number obviously could be set at whatever bar to establish that they are. If the intention is that they be full-time workers, whether they're full-time and temporary or full-time and what you could consider permanent, 30 hours was selected as a benchmark. But no, if they're working 30 hours, those hours are not going to be considered toward the 1,200. If there are other workers who are also there working at the same time, working more than 30, those hours would be considered. So, yes, this is it is a policy choice how that's structured. And right now, the hours would need to be worked by a worker who's working 30 hours in that week to be in the sum.
Then, if I may follow up, Madam Chair, that's not how Representative Barnhart reads it, nor how I would intend it, because it's clear that if the goal is you have one FTE, and we want to encourage people to grow businesses, so the fact that they may have flexibility with employee hours, you're still having one FTE if that FTE is 30 plus hours a week for an aggregate of 1,200. So we got a problem with the language if that's what you're saying, how you drafted it, although Representative Barnhart reads it the way I want it to read, but I'm troubled.
Madam Chair, just simply to clarify, the way I read this, I think, the way I read this is that there are really two tests. Test number one is that a worker, in order to be counted toward the second test, has to have worked 30 hours in a week, a worker. There might be 10 workers who each work 30 hours in a week, in which case you get 10 weeks' worth of 30 hours is out of those 10 workers. The second test is that when you add up those 30 hours is, or 40 hours is, or whatever it is, you end up at the end of the year with 1,200 hours or more in order to get this qualification. That's the way I read it. And I think that's what LC has told us the language was intended to say. And the point, I think, is, if I understand, and I had nothing to do with the conversation that led to this paragraph, but if I understand it correctly, the idea is that only a person who's full-time, definition of full-time is 30 hours or more in a week, is counted toward these 1,200 aggregate hours. Now, you know, it's possible the committee wants to do something else. If it were my druthers to figure this out, I'd make it 40 hours a week, and I'd make it quite a bit more than 1,200 hours, like maybe 2,000 hours, because that would be the equivalent of one person working 50 hours, working 50 weeks at a full-time rate of 40 hours a week. But it's the same test, but a different number of hours. I don't know if I'm reading it the same way council is, but I think we're saying the same thing.
Representative Barnhart, Chair Kotek, I believe that you stated it exactly as I read it, and I believe as it was intended and as it departed from the original version, which clearly envisioned one full-time employee meeting the requirement.
Representative McLean and then Senator.
Well, I will say that other than Chris Garrett's billing hours at his law firm, I don't think people working 2,000 hours a week, a year is reality because of vacations and holidays and the like in that regard. And that's why I think the number's lower. But I'm troubled by this because we are going to penalize, if this language doesn't change, employers that offer job share opportunities or anything like that. They're basically going to say, sorry, if you won't, in other words, I could have one FTE or two full-time workers, and the fact that they can't split up, I don't think is our intent. It was a full-time worker, and it was a 1,200 hours aggregate, and I think we have to make an adjustment to this language.
Senator Burdick?
Madam Chair, thank you. Maybe I can shed a little light on this. I was closer to the negotiations on this. We started out with a full-time 40-hour FTE non-family member, because our intent was to this tax rate is so preferable that there's going to be a strong incentive for people to try to get in on this tax rate. We wanted to do everything we could to limit it to businesses that actually were businesses that would be more likely to use the money to put back in the business. We put the employee requirement in as a kind of a guarantee that they actually are a business, they have an employee. The 1,200 hours, the 30 hours a week, was a compromise. And that's where it came from. We also compromised and allowed family members in. The original draft that we had did not allow family members to qualify this for this. We don't want people who have an incentive to, you know, to get into this low tax rate who are not actual businesses. And I think if you look at the seasonal working, there are others who know more about seasonal work than I do, but I can't imagine that a serious agricultural operation doing seasonal work wouldn't be able to easily meet this standard.
Representative McClain?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I was fairly close to negotiations as well, and if I recall, it was pretty clear that it was to accommodate agriculture, and the fireworks stand was an example used multiple times. So we need to accommodate agriculture and the seasonality of their jobs and allow that flexibility. And if that intent isn't here, then we need to change it.
I think we'll be having a discussion offline of this, and I will keep my comments to the offline conversation. Further questions for Elsie? I have one quick one, Representative.
It's probably maybe the similar one. I'm wondering. You heard much of the testimony tonight, or much of the conversation. Is there any part of the of what you heard from the from let's say a revenue office that you think is not reflected in this draft?
Representative Barnhart, Chair Kotek, I heard, I believe, much of the discussion, and no, I believe it is reflected in this draft.
All right, and the question I asked them about the definition of the denominator in the trigger, I don't know whether that's a concern or not. If it raises a concern, I hope you will address it. I'm talking about line 4, page 18, actual total income in this state. And they gave me a definition that had to do with tax returns. And it seems to me you could read this in a whole bunch of different ways. Perhaps a tighter definition would be useful.
Representative Barnhart, Chair Kotek, we have discussed whether there is the need for a definition. I believe it does work the way it is drafted, and certainly this calculation can be achieved. I'm not sure if there's some further refinement that would make it even more clear, but having read through this numerous times and also having discussed it at length with the Legislative Revenue Office, I believe it does work.
Could you just, for the record, give us the definition of actual total income in this state as it applies here?
Chair Kotek, I do not have an actual definition that's in statute. I know that that's a term that is used, and it's used in the development of projections. I don't know that it wouldn't be clearer if we did establish a definition. That might be something to explore. I don't have a definition, a written definition, this evening.
And that's, if you want to take that back under advisement and come back to us in the morning, that'd be helpful. I see Mr. Warner over there. I'm sure he's got ideas, and maybe there aren't changes, but we appreciate you looking into that.
Thank you, Madam.
You're welcome. And this might be more of a question for Paul. Jody had a comment about, Ms. Weiser had a comment about the time period of which someone could establish as a domestic international sales corporation. And I guess my understanding from conversations we've had is that's not something you just turn around overnight. And that, and the goal of Section 6 on page 13 is that the idea that unless you are filed as an IC DISC on the effective date of this act, this does not apply to you. So I guess there was some implication that somehow between passage of the bill and the effective date in the bill, there would be this rush to folks to create domestic international sales corporations. And I'm just trying to understand how complicated that is. Yes, Senator Burdick?
I had some extensive, Dr. Warner's here, so we'll let him take it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. ICDISC is something that's been around in different forms for quite a while. It goes back to the early 70s when it was just the DISC, and then it became the ICDISC in 1984. We have not seen rapid growth from that type of structure. There's some pretty strict requirements in terms of the way they're organized and structured. There has to be 95% of the sales have to be export sales. They're not a corporation in the sense that they have assets. It's a booking requirement in which those that are have large export sectors as a percentage of their sales can organize this separate unit in order to calculate their export activity through that unit. So we haven't seen, as I say, we haven't seen a lot of growth in that federally. There is a pretty strong federal incentive to organize this way. As income comes into the ICDISC, it's deferred for federal corporate tax purposes and then paid when it's paid out to its shareholders, then it's taxed at a dividend rate. So the dividend rate is favorable in the federal tax law relative to other tax rates. For Oregon, we wouldn't have that advantage. So the main advantage is that shows up is in that lower corporate rate that would be associated with a parent that has a ICDISC that is a C corporation. So we wouldn't have a favorable rate pass through to non-C corporations that hold this ICDISC. So we don't see it as a large incentive. We don't think there's a lot of potential ICDISC corporations out there. We think it's pretty narrow in its scope. We don't know exactly how many there are now, but we suspect there's probably maybe 50 to 100 of them in Oregon now. So we would not anticipate a large increase over the next couple of months. Over time, we think that export activity will grow, and we may see some increase. Basically, our growth is based on just kind of general growth in exports, the projected growth for exports. But as we go over time, maybe 4 to 5 years from now, we may see growing interest from those that want to get in under that that have formed after the deadline.
And that would be a further
policy issue for you to address, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for entertaining that, colleagues. Any other questions for the drafter or Mr. Warner? If not, we will close public hearing on 3601. And colleagues, we also have House Bill 5101 on our agenda, and I will, just for the sake of process, open a public hearing on House Bill 5101. We don't have anyone scheduled to testify. This is the appropriation bill. We have Mr. Rocco here. I apologize. Mr. Rocco is here.
Lisa, you want to testify?
Lisa would like to testify.
I want to tell him something. Just to tell us that she supports mental health.
I'm not going to say. I don't want to be interrupted by the press when I'm doing this. We're doing the best we can. We're taking one day at a time, and we'll see how things go.
Mr. Rocco, it's such a pleasure. Would you like to talk to us about House Bill 5101?
Madam Chair.
Colleagues.
Members of the committee, Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. House Bill 5101 has only one change from the LC draft that you looked at last week. It has a new Section 2, which stipulates that the $100 million for the state school fund will be spent in the 2014-15 school year or the second year of the current biennium. And that's the only change.
Thank you, Mr. Rocco. And as you recall from last week, colleagues, we did see a detail of the different areas of spending and the special purpose appropriations and the various assorted. That has not changed. We have one person who's interested in testifying. Lisa?
Hurry. Come on, Lisa.
Talk fast.
Dina.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Lisa Nato, and Madam Speaker, co-chair, and President Courtney, co-chair. I'm here as a private citizen today simply to say thank you. Many of you know I have one of my four brothers who suffers from severe mental illness. And on behalf of my family, and to acknowledge many of you know the need for mental health services in our community, and I want to thank you for your coming together in a bipartisan manner to make a substantial step forward to fund adequately mental health services so that people like my brother will be able to lead a dignified life in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Shall we say congratulations to Lisa, though? Because she's going to be honored for her work.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Senator Wears. Thanks for recognizing that. Seems like a good spot to end the evening on. I'll close the public hearing on 5101. Colleagues?
She should have called her.
I believe we are scheduled to... So we are set to reconvene at 8:30 in the morning. I know, bright and early. We've got a long day ahead of us tomorrow. We probably have a few tinkering amendments that we'll have to deal with. The goal would be to try to amend the bills and move them out. And
what sort of penalty will we enact if we don't actually get do anything until 10 a.m.?
I expect everyone bright and bushy-tailed at 8:30 in the morning. Now, of course, Senator Courtney has the gavel first thing in the morning, and he is very prompt. I'm obviously a little bit more of a slacker. So unless there are any questions.
Technical question. So we're scheduled for 8:30.
Yes.
Does that mean that all the paperwork and some of the technical pieces will be completed at 8:30? Shall we make it at 9?
Well, I'm not sure we will have, for example, we might not have all the FISs and RISs, the fiscal impacts and revenue impacts done. However, I know Legislative Council, since we started at 5:30, has been accumulating the changes. Hopefully, we'll at least have draft amendment language first thing so we can make sure that's adopted, and perhaps we'll have to recess for waiting for additional paperwork. But the goal is to move as quickly as possible in the morning, and I know it's late and staff are probably still working. So, unfortunately.
Since those of you are that are maybe coming from the northern part of the state, it's been customary in, I think, some of us in budget to make certain that you've got Krispy Kremers or something that are here at 8. Mm-hmm.
I believe the person with the gavel in the morning will take care of that. Thank you, Senator President Courtney.
Care of everything this morning already.
Anything for you, Senator Wears. I'll try to pick up some donuts on the way in.
8:30
here with that. Colleagues, we're adjourned. See you in the morning. If the record is off, see you in the morning. If the record is off.